cry. She wanted to kill someone, preferably her two evil stepsisters, who would be enjoying a windfall due to their father's carelessness. Sophie hadn't gotten that far yet, and Sidney refused to go there. She had loved him deeply in life and intended to continue doing so in death. Sabrina wasn't as loyal or as noble as she. She had always had a fiery personality, detested injustice of any kind, and was willing to fight for what she believed.
"You have to move out?"
Sabrina stared at her in shock and dismay.
"The girls gave me 30 days,
Sidney almost whispered.
"And what about everything that's here? The furniture, the art, everything you bought together? He can't have wanted them to have that, too."
"Their father paid for it. It's theirs. He didn't know me when he wrote his will." Sidney could almost see steam coming from her daughter's ears and a look of rage in her eyes.
"And they didn't agree to give you some kind of grace period until you can get organized and find a decent place to live?"
Sabrina asked, and Sidney shook her head. She didn't want to tell them that she could no longer afford a decent place, and even the tiny furnished apartment in the shabby building would be a stretch.
"Have you talked to an attorney?"
"Obviously. There's nothing I can do. The will is what it is, and our prenup makes it worse because we waived any right to community property. And since he paid for everything, it was all his, and now it's theirs, except for any gifts he made me and put in writing, like my jewelry in the Paris apartment. All I brought to the marriage was what I'd saved while I was working, and I spent that a long time ago." It was hard to admit it to them, but she wanted to be honest with her daughters.
"Did he make any kind of financial provision for you, Mom?" Sabrina asked practically. "Did he put money aside for you? I'm sorry to be nosy about it, but I assumed you'd be okay if anything ever happened to him. I never expected you to lose the house or have to leave."
Both girls looked shaken to the core. What their mother had told them was hard to believe. The estate where she and Andrew had lived was one of the largest and most beautiful on the East Coast.
"We had a joint checking account I ran the house with, and that he let me spend for anything I wanted for myself. I have the apartment in Paris, which I'm going to sell eventually. I'm waiting for the market there to improve, and I'm going to rent it in the meantime, which will give me a small income. I have some jewelry, which I can sell, too, and I'll need to work."
"Oh, my God, Mom." Sabrina sat back in her chair at the kitchen table and stared at her. They were like two versions of the same face, light and dark, the yin and yang. Sabrina had her mother's delicate features, but where Sidney's hair was blonde, Sabrina's was shining ebony. Sophie's looks were softer, rounder. She wasn't as tall as her mother or sister, and for genetic reasons no one could explain, her hair was red.
"When did you find out?"
her older daughter asked her.
"The day after the funeral. Jesse came to see me."
"Why didn't you tell us?" Sophie asked gently, her heart aching for her mother.
"It's only been a little over 2 weeks, and I needed time to absorb it myself. That's why I went to Paris, to put the apartment on the market. I'm going to start calling employment agencies this week. I don't know what they're going to say, though. I haven't had a job in 16 years. I'm hoping to find some kind of work involving fashion or design, but I might have to do something else."
She looked worried as she said it, and Sophie leaned over and took her mother's hand in her own.
"You don't forget how to design clothes," she said gently. "My skills are totally archaic in today's world. People don't even wear what I used to design anymore. I'm thinking that I may be obsolete."
She was frightened
and hated to seem so vulnerable to her daughters, but there was no hiding from the truth.
"Will you be okay in the meantime until you find a job?" Sabrina asked her seriously.
"I will when I sell the apartment in Paris and am employed. Until then, I can manage for a while, but it's going to be pretty tight. There's still enough in the checking account to pay for some essentials for a short time, but not forever."
It was humbling to have to admit to her daughters that she was nearly flat broke, and there was no way she was going to be a burden on either of them or borrow money from them. Sabrina made an enormous salary, deservedly so, for the work she did, designing 4 collections a year. And Sophie did reasonably well, although she made less than her sister, designing clothes for teens. And Andrew and her mother had helped fill in the gaps occasionally when she needed it. Sydney couldn't do that anymore either, and glanced at her apologetically. This was the ultimate reversal of fortune. One minute she'd been living a luxurious and secure life, and the next she would be living in a tiny apartment, desperate to find a job, if she even could.
"If nothing else, I can sell clothes in a boutique," she said humbly, willing to do whatever she had to.
"That's ridiculous," Sabrina said through clenched teeth. "Look at this house and everything in it, for God's sake, and now you're going to be a sales girl somewhere? Come on, Mom. The girls can't do that to you. They don't need the money. Andrew must have left them a huge fortune if they got everything he had, and he's been giving them money for years. His father left them a trust fund, and their mother has a ton of money." Marjorie was one of the most successful interior designers in L.A. and a favorite among the Bel Air set, and had done homes for some of the big stars, not to mention the settlements she'd gotten from Andrew years before.
"That's all true, but we're stuck with the will. He never changed it. Sometimes life works out that way. I'm not happy about it either, but I have to make the best of it. What other choice do I have?"
Sabrina felt tears of anger sting her eyes as her mother thought of something, left the table, and came back a minute later with Paul Zeller's card. She'd found it in her bag the night before and wanted to show it to them.
"I told you about the man I sat next to on the plane. He's a really nice person, and he seems to have some huge clothing company. I got the impression that he sells low-priced goods. He said to give him a call if I ever want to get back into design. He has factories in China, and he was terrific to me when I was terrified. I was thinking this morning that maybe I should call him. I don't remember the name of his company when you asked the other day." She handed the business card to Sabrina. "It's called Lady Louise."
Sabrina closed her eyes when she heard the words and let out a groan. "Oh, please, don't tell me that's who you met on your flight. He's the scourge of the industry. You should have pushed him into the Atlantic while you had the chance. Do you know who he is?"
Sydney shook her head. Sophie looked disappointed, too. She recognized the name of the firm as well. Everyone in the fashion industry knew it.
"He's the biggest knockoff mogul in the clothing business," Sabrina said. "He copies every decent designer there is. He doesn't even try to disguise it. He hires young designers fresh out of school who don't know better, pays them 10 times what they're worth, and has a fleet of people running around to photograph every good-looking piece of clothing that's made. He's shameless. He changes just enough so he gets away with it, and you can't copyright most clothing designs anyway. He produces it all in China for pennies with crap fabrics and gets it into the stores before any of us can get our products shipped. You can buy his copies before you can buy my designs that he knocks off. There's nothing respectable about him. He's never sold an original garment. He makes schlock of the worst kind.
He says there's a market for what he sells, and he's bringing real fashion to people who could never afford it before," Sydney said. "The concept is a good one, if that's true. Not everyone can afford the clothes you produce, Sabrina. In fact, damn few people can. What's wrong with bringing real fashion to the masses? Don't be such a purist.
Sabrina looked outraged by what her mother said. Nothing's wrong with it if his design staff came up with their own creations occasionally, or did inspirations. All they do is copy the rest of us as cheaply as they can and let us do all the work figuring out which way the winds are blowing every season. He's just a giant copy machine, Mom. I've never seen a single thing they produced that was original. He even copies what Sophie makes for teens. You can't work for an outfit like that. You have a name. People still remember what you did. I find your dresses sometimes in vintage shops when I'm doing research. You made beautiful clothes. You didn't copy anyone. You had your own style. People still respect the name of Sydney Smith 20 years later. You'll be a laughingstock, and so will we if you go to work for him.
You can't be such a snob, Sabrina. And sooner or later, I'll need a job to pay my bills. I can't pick and choose.
Do anything, whatever you want, but don't go to work for someone like him. He's the bottom of the barrel.
Sabrina was begging her, and Sophie echoed her sister, although more gently, as usual. Mom, no one respects what they do in the industry. Sabrina's right. They even knock us off. And our line is young and inexpensive, not up in the stratosphere like Sabrina's. He copies everyone and everything without shame. Trust us, he's a bottom feeder. It's all cheesy knockoffs. They don't respect anyone, and not a single thing they sell is their own design. It's all someone else's, but cheaper and worse.
Sydney was silently wondering if she should look for herself. The concept of Lady Louise was good. The products they manufactured couldn't be all bad. She knew how rabid Sabrina was about her designs, but Sabrina worked for a firm that could afford to charge whatever they wanted based on the name, and the quality of their clothes was top of the line. Sophie was less of an elitist, and even she disapproved of him. But there was room in the market for low-priced products. It had made sense to Sydney when she was talking to Paul Zeller in Nova Scotia, but she decided not to press the point with them. They both looked seriously upset that she would even consider asking him for a job. Anyway, he was incredibly kind when the plane nearly crashed. I was scared to death, and for a while it looked like we were going down in the water. I would have panicked without him.
Thank God you didn't crash, Sophie said with fervor. We'd be lost without you, Mom. Brina and I will help you find a job, won't we?
She glanced pointedly at her older sister, and Sabrina nodded, unnerved by everything she'd heard during lunch. Their mother was being forced out of her home by her stepdaughters. Her late husband hadn't provided for her and had left her no money, and she had been thinking about going to work for the worst third-rate knockoff outfit in the business. It was fully clear to them that their mother's situation was critical, even if she appeared to be calm about it. But now they realized that the ravaged look in her eyes was not just grief from losing the husband she loved, but also financial desperation and the shock of losing everything to the twins.
"We'll come and help you move, Mom," Sabrina said quietly.
"And tell those two witches to stay out of the house until you do."
"I can't do that," Sydney said realistically. "They own it now. And I gather Kelly is moving in. She wants to make some changes, but they needed a bigger house, and now she has one."
Sydney didn't sound bitter about it, just matter-of-fact and sad. "Yeah, and that jerk she's married to would like nothing better than showing off with a house like this," Sabrina said vehemently. They hated Kelly's husband, Jeff, too, and Sydney wasn't fond of him either. He was pretentious and arrogant, based on no accomplishment of his own,
but only his wife's money, which he flaunted and spent at every opportunity. Andrew hadn't been crazy about him, but Kelly loved him, and now they had two kids. He had been a stock analyst on Wall Street when she met him, but had quit his job the minute he married her and hadn't worked since. They had been married for 9 years, and now they had hit the jackpot, and he was going to have a field day strutting around. The thought of it made Sabrina sick, even more so than it did her mother. Sydney was still dazed by the wrecking ball that had hit her, and too terrified and shaken up to be angry at anyone. She was overwhelmed with fear of the future. All three of them were subdued for the rest of the weekend, and the two girls discussed their mother's situation all the way back to New York on Sunday night. They worried that she'd be unable to get a job and would run out of money. "She can live with me if she wants to," Sophie said generously, but Sabrina was more sensible. "Neither of you is going to want that forever. She's too young to just live with you like some old dowager. She needs a life and a job, apparently. This is going to be so hard on her," Sabrina said unhappily. "At least we talked her out of going to work for Paul Zeller. That would have killed me." Sophie smiled at the thought. The idea of it was ridiculous, even to her. "I'm glad he was nice to her on the plane. He must be semi-human, after all," she said, giving him the benefit of the doubt, despite the fact that he was the archenemy of all talented creative designers and copied every item of clothing they made. "I can't understand how Andrew did that to her," Sabrina said. "You'd think that sometime during all these years he'd have written a new will to include her. I can't believe the twins are getting everything and kicking her out of the house. I hate them more than ever." But she was angry at Andrew now, too. He had disappointed her, and his failure to do what he should have done had hurt their mother badly. "He just didn't expect to die at his age," Sophie said. But it didn't seem like an adequate explanation to either of them. It was a failure of gargantuan proportions from a man who knew better and had loved their mother. "Neither did our father when he went down on the plane in Zimbabwe. He didn't have a will either," Sabrina reminded her.
"He didn't need one. He didn't have anything. Andrew did," Sophie said, thinking about it again and wondering what would happen to their mother. Sophie wanted to comfort and protect her, and Sabrina wanted to ride into battle for her. But there was no one to fight. Andrew was dead and had left nothing to their mother. The twins owned everything. Sophie and Sabrina knew their mother was going to have to figure out a way to survive somehow. But how? There were no easy answers, and tough times ahead.
Chapter 3. For the next 10 days, Sydney packed her clothes and personal belongings. She went through Andrew's books and all the little things that she knew had meant a lot to him, sentimental objects and photographs, the albums of the trips they'd taken. She packed the souvenirs of their years together, not necessarily objects of value, although a few were, but they were things that she treasured. She had stacks of boxes to take to the New York apartment, along with her clothes. She weeded through her closets and took out things to sell that she wouldn't wear anymore, and set up several racks for her daughters to go through for themselves, of beautiful, expensive things she thought they'd like. She took a storage unit to put some special clothes away that she didn't need but wasn't ready to part with. It was a full-time job, and the housekeeper worked every day to help her. They both cried while they did it. She was rolling a rack of things to sell out of her bedroom into the hall when Veronica showed up again, unannounced, and looking mournful. She had brought her a sandwich and a Caesar salad in case she was hungry, but Sydney didn't want to waste time eating. Veronica lingered, trying to chat, and Sydney finally told her she was too busy. So she left.
There was something invasive about Veronica's visits, though Sydney felt guilty for thinking that as she went back to work. The twins dropped by every day now to check on her progress and see if anything they considered valuable had disappeared. Kira complained when she noticed that a small pink enamel Fabergé clock encrusted with pearls and tiny rubies was no longer on Sydney's night table, and she asked her stepmother where it was.
"Your father gave it to me for my birthday when I turned 40," Sydney replied,
and Kira shrugged. She could afford to buy a dozen new ones, but had always liked it. "Dad said I could have it." Kira tried, but convinced no one, and Sydney didn't bother to respond. She had enough on her mind. She had postponed her job search until she got to New York. She had too much to do getting ready to move. And on her last night in the home she had loved and shared with Andrew, she was grateful to be alone. She just wanted to be there with her memories. She had packed up his clothes, along with her own, and sent them to storage. She wasn't ready to dispose of them yet, and didn't want to leave them for Kira and Kelly to pick through, sell, or give to Jeff. Putting them in storage made it feel like she was taking Andrew with her, although more and more it was becoming a reality that he was gone. And she admitted it to no one, but there were moments now when she was angry at him for what he'd allowed to happen to her at his daughter's hands. She was being stripped of everything, not only art and furniture, but the home that had been her refuge, her status as a married woman, her feeling of safety, and all the remnants and familiar landmarks of her life with him. All she had left was his name. The twins were claiming almost everything else. The moving van came the morning she was supposed to leave the house, 30 days after Andrew's death, to take what she was sending to storage and the rest to the tiny apartment in New York. She stood in her bedroom for a long moment, and then walked quietly down the stairs with a lump in her throat the size of a fist, and kissed the housekeeper goodbye. Sydney could no longer afford her, and Kelly had hired her. She needed the job, so she was staying, but she said it broke her heart. Sydney didn't look back as she drove away in her station wagon. She couldn't. She knew that if she did, she wouldn't have been able to go any farther. She had to go forward, and she saw Kelly drive in through the gates as soon as she drove out to follow the moving truck to the city. It was a hot day and stifling in the apartment without air conditioning. The elevator was small and slow, so it took forever to unload the truck. Sabrina and Sophie showed up that afternoon as she was stacking boxes at the back of the second bedroom she was using as a closet, and Sophie helped set up racks for her clothes. She had brought all the things she thought she'd wear most in her new city life, or if she got a job. She had brought a few cocktail dresses and evening gowns, in case she had a social life, but she couldn't imagine it now. She'd had notes from friends promising to call her, but no one had so far. Veronica had warned her that, as an attractive single woman, she would be a threat to her married friends, which Sydney hadn't believed at first. But maybe it was true. And rumors had spread quickly that she was moving out of the house. Whatever the reason, embarrassment, discretion, or cowardice, she had heard from no one in the weeks since the funeral. Only Veronica called and showed up. And it seemed she always had some piece of bad news to share. Sydney had started avoiding her calls. She just didn't want to hear it anymore. She'd enough bad news of her own, without Veronica making her feel worse. Sophie had arrived at the apartment in cut-off white denim shorts and a pink T-shirt from the brand she worked for, with sandals that laced up her slim legs. The clothes she designed were young and fresh. Sophie wore them a lot. They suited her, and made her appear even younger than she was, with her mane of curly red hair. She looked like a teenager herself, totally different from her sister. Sabrina was wearing a black cotton dress of her own chic design with high-heeled sandals, and seemed like she was going to a fancy lunch somewhere, with her dark hair pulled severely back. And Sydney was wearing jeans and an old shirt of Andrew's, and feeling disoriented. This didn't feel real. The tiny, ugly apartment couldn't be hers. The girls were upset when they saw it, and Sabrina disappeared for a while to buy flowers while Sophie helped her mother hang her clothes and did all she could to make the agonizing process easier for her. She still wished her mother would move in with her, although Sydney was determined not to impose on either of them. It took them all day to get the apartment organized in order to fit everything into the limited space. By 8 o'clock that night, they finished. There was nothing left to do. They had done all they could, and most of what she'd brought had to stay in boxes. There was no place to put it. The flowers Sabrina had bought and arranged in vases made the place look more cheerful, but Sydney had the feeling that she was camping out. All she could think of was Kelly moving into her home. She was exhausted when she finally sat down on the couch and gazed at her daughters. There was nothing any of them could say to make the moment better. It had been a hard day. The harsh reality of her life now was staring them all in the face. "Why don't we go out to dinner?" Sabrina suggested. There were several restaurants in the neighborhood, but no one leapt at the idea. They were all feeling worn out, and no one was hungry. But both girls wanted to bolster their mother's spirits. "I don't think you can get me off this couch with a crowbar," Sydney said, drained. "I'm so tired. I don't think I can walk or eat," she said honestly. It had been a rugged day, leaving one home and trying to turn this place, the size of a closet, into another. She realized now that there were no window shades, and she'd have to buy them, and the towels looked like they'd been stolen from a cheap motel. They were rough and small, gray from too many washings, and she wanted to buy new ones. Kelly had made a point of telling her to leave the linens at the house, and she had. She wasn't going to fight over hand towels and washcloths, although she had brought 3 sets of her favorite sheets. They had so many, Kelly would never miss them. "I think I forgot to bring soap," she said vaguely, in a wan voice, and Sophie volunteered that she had brought toilet paper with her that morning. The two girls left together, with Sydney still sitting on the couch, and they promised to come back the next day and take their mother out somewhere. The two young women agreed as they shared a cab downtown that their mother seemed battered, but it had been grueling for them, too. What Sydney had brought with her, it seemed like so little on the truck in Connecticut, but once it got to the apartment, everything seemed to have grown in the shrunken surroundings. It made them realize again how hard this was going to be on her, and what a huge change. She called them both the next day and told them she was too tired to get out of bed. It was raining, and she wanted to stay home. They tried to talk her out of it, but couldn't, and finally agreed to leave her on her own. She insisted she'd be fine. She set out her photographs of Andrew and the girls on every surface where she could fit them, and she spent the rest of the day in bed, watching movies on the tiny ancient TV in her bedroom. And on Monday, forcing herself, Sydney went down her list of employment agencies and called them all. She had 4 appointments for that week and was determined not to lose momentum. She couldn't look back now, or down, as though she were climbing a cliff and hanging on by her fingernails. She just had to keep going until she reached a place that felt safe to stop, and she hadn't reached it yet. The abyss was still yawning below her, and she was afraid to fall. All of her meetings at the agencies were discouraging, and by Friday she'd heard the same thing over and over again. She had been out of the job market for too long, her experience was no longer relevant, she was too old and competing with people half her age for jobs. They suggested that she consider some other line of work in fashion instead of design. Editorial assistant at a magazine, perhaps, or working in a designer boutique or on the designer floor at a department store. No one took her seriously as a designer, and at 4 o'clock on Friday she took Paul's card out of her bag again, where she had left it after showing it to the girls, and called him. She wasn't going to beg for a job, which she realized she was no longer suited to, but she was going to ask him if he had any suggestions for her. She had no idea where to turn next. The people she'd worked with many years before all seemed to have disappeared. She couldn't find any of them listed in information or on the Internet. She was touched when Paul took her call and came on the line immediately. His voice sounded pleasant and upbeat, and it was a relief to hear. "Hi, Sydney. What have you been up to?" He seemed like he really wanted to know, and she wasn't sure if she should tell him the truth or lie. She was running out of steam. It had been a brutal week. "Well, let's see. Since the plane crash, I moved out of my house in Connecticut into an apartment the size of a phone booth," she said. "I saw 4 employment agencies this week, and before I take a job as a waitress, I thought I'd give you a call and pick your brain to see if you have any bright ideas. It's either that or work at Starbucks." He could hear from the timbre of her voice that things were not going well, despite her attempt to make a joke of it. "Have you ever been a waitress before?" he asked, sounding startled. "Actually, no." "Then why not stick with what you know? Let's have lunch on Monday, and we'll talk. Don't sign up at Starbucks just yet." "I'll try to resist the temptation," she said, and laughed, and felt better just talking to him. He'd had the same effect on her when their plane nearly crashed, and he told her they'd be fine. She believed him. "What else have you been up to? How are your daughters?" "They've been terrific. They helped me move over the weekend." He could only imagine how traumatic it must have been for her to leave her house only weeks after losing her husband. He stayed off painful subjects while they chatted for a few minutes. He told her to meet him at his office, which was in an old warehouse they'd transformed in Hell's Kitchen. They had facilities in New Jersey as well. He told her to come at noon, and he'd show her around. There were several good restaurants in the neighborhood, and he'd take her to lunch after the tour. "See you then," she said. "And, Paul, thank you for seeing me. I need some fresh ideas."
"I'll see what I can come up with this weekend," he promised.
And her spirits had improved slightly when she hung up. She had something to look forward to, and she wasn't going to tell her girls she'd called him. They had a visceral prejudice against the kind of clothes he made, and she wasn't going to try and convince them otherwise. They were cheap copies of expensive clothes, but there was obviously a market for them. If nothing else, after their experience in Nova Scotia, she and Paul had become friends, and she needed some of those right now. Her old friends from Connecticut seemed to have disappeared the minute Andrew died. Veronica's theory about married women not wanting divorced or widowed female friends around was proving to be accurate. She had disagreed with Veronica when she said it, but maybe she knew what she was talking about. There wasn't a single part of Sydney's life that hadn't changed. She spent a quiet weekend, since both her daughters were in the Hamptons, and she took a long walk in Central Park and watched couples strolling and families picnicking together. She listened to a reggae band for a few minutes and sat on a bench and observed the world drifting by. And then she went back to her apartment and tried to read a book, but her mind had been blank since Andrew died, and she couldn't concentrate. So she lay on her bed, which filled her entire bedroom, and fell asleep. And on Monday morning, she headed for Hell's Kitchen on the subway. She was wearing a white linen dress with big turquoise beads, flat sandals, and a chic straw bag, and her hair was pulled neatly back. She looked fresh and summery when she gave her name to a pretty young girl at the reception desk.
Suddenly, the whole world seemed half her age, and the people she saw coming and going around her all looked like kids. It was a relief to see Paul walking toward her a few minutes later with a smile on his face. He was delighted to see her. He gave her a hug and greeting and told her she looked terrific, and they went back to his office to talk before he showed her around.
"You know, I thought about you all weekend," he said seriously, "trying to come up with some bright ideas for you to reinvent yourself, but I kept coming to the same conclusion." "That's crazy. You were a terrific designer when you retired. That doesn't go away. You can't throw away a talent like that. Nor should you. It's like teaching Picasso to be a busboy or an engineer. Why would you want to do that? You're an artist, Sydney, a talented designer. You've been out of the business for a while, and you may not have the computer skills that kids do these days, but it wouldn't take you long to get up to speed. And as long as you have a piece of paper and a pencil, who cares how you come up with designs or what you draw them on? Look at you. You're fabulous. You know just how to put it together. Why would you want to give that up? You took a break. Now you want to come back. Why not give it a shot?"
"Because no one will hire me," she said honestly. "At least, that's what the employment agencies told me last week. I've been away from it for too long. My point of view has changed. The world has changed. I don't have a commercial touch anymore. And everyone in the business is half my age. Look at my kids. They're 25 and 27, and they're at the top of their game. I'm over the hill," she said, trying not to sound as discouraged as she felt.
"That's bullshit. You have experience they don't have, and perspective. You have an overview of fashion, which adds dimension. You know what's already been done, what worked and what didn't. A lot of these kids are still very one-dimensional. They haven't seen enough yet. And too many of them rely on their computers and don't really have talent. How many really do? You know it as well as I do. They can draw, but they can't design. They don't have enough to bring it yet. They've seen last year and 2 years ago. You've seen a hell of a lot more than that. It matters, and you have your own style. Most of these kids don't. They all look like bums sleeping under a bridge." And she knew he wasn't wrong about that. It was the current style.
"So what are you telling me? I did give it a shot, going to see the agencies."
Listening to him, she almost believed him, but it wasn't happening. In fashion now, youth was king, and the one thing she couldn't do was erase her age. "I'm telling you, give me a shot. Give us a chance. Come to work for me. If you talk to your daughters about me, I'm sure they tried to scare you off. They're at the top of their field. They work in an elitist world. Even the line for teenagers your younger daughter works for. Their prices are still above ours, but the truth is, that isn't always what sells. Designers like your kids hate people like me, because we borrow heavily, I admit it, but we bring fashion to everyone. We make looking great accessible to the masses at prices they can afford. And if you want to try it, you can work in some original designs and do some signature pieces for us. I'd really like to give it a try, and if it doesn't work, then we'll have learned something from it. I think we need each other. And if you want to use your name here, you can. I have no objection to it. I'd love it. We can give you your own label for what you design. Sydney Smith for Lady Louise." That was my grandmother's name, by the way. She was a seamstress and a cool old dame. I named the company after her. She came here from Poland and taught me everything I know about life and clothes. What do you think? Sydney could just hear Sabrina shrieking in horror if she heard their conversation. But so much of what he said made sense. And he was right. Designers like Sabrina were enormous snobs about fashion and created for an elite few. There was plenty of room in the market for a different kind of customer.
It sounded challenging to Sidney, and like fun.
"I'll give you a tour," Paul said. "I want to show you our design studio."
She followed him out of his office and up a flight of stairs. The building had an industrial look to it, which appealed to her. It was all very different from the lofty atmosphere she'd worked in before. This was fresh and young. He led her into an enormous room where 20 designers were working at tables, sketching, working on computers and correcting designs, with color swatches and bits of fabric hanging over their desks. Some of them had photographs on their screens of clothes she recognized, and she knew what that meant. They were copying more expensive designs, but Paul didn't deny it, and he assured her that they modified them enough to keep them from being exact copies. Most clothing designs couldn't be protected or copyrighted, but he still had his designers change a pocket or a sleeve length or a skirt to keep them from being identical to the designs that inspired them. They gave them a new twist the original designer may not have thought of, dared, or been allowed to do. She walked from table to table quietly and was shocked at the youthful age of the designers. They were dressed like orphans and street people. There were as many girls as boys, and they all looked intent on their work. It was an impressive operation, and on the floor above them were the pattern makers, working diligently, adjusting the designs to make sure they worked. It was exciting being back in the familiar milieu on a much larger scale. Paul had more of everything. There were so many of them, it looked like a school, and in a way, it was. They were all learning something new, and she had new techniques to learn, too. She toured the building with him, and they wound up back in the lobby, and then he walked her down the street to an Italian restaurant with a garden for lunch. The day was just cool enough to sit outside. He ordered a Bloody Mary, and they ordered lunch, and she talked about what they'd seen. She asked him a lot of questions, and his answers seemed straightforward and sounded right to her. She was touched that he was willing to give her a chance. She had a feeling that no one else would, and certainly not a firm like the one Sabrina worked for, or others like it. She'd been gone for too long, but not for Paul. "I'll do it," she said, halfway through lunch. And he glanced at her in surprise.
"Do you mean what I think you mean? What I hope you mean?" he asked,
and she nodded and broke into a smile. "If you want me, yes, I do," she confirmed.
"I can't pay you what you made before when you stopped working, but in the long run, you'll make more here, a lot more, if you take the kind of strong role I hope you will. Sidney, we have a home for you for the long haul, if you want it. You could have a major impact here."
He made her feel competent, relevant, and important, and not like a has-been. He gave her the hope that she could work her way out of the financial mess she was in. "I do want it," she said seriously, and suddenly, nearly dying in a plane crash with him, had become the best thing that had happened to her in a long time, and recently, for sure.
"When can you start?" he asked, beaming at her, and she laughed.
"Tomorrow?
Sidney, you're on."
He got up and walked around the table to hug her, and it reminded her of Nova Scotia again, when he had told her that everything would be okay, and she believed him. And now he was making that promise come true. She clung to him for a moment and thanked him, and he ordered champagne when he sat down again.
"My grandmother would approve," he said, smiling at her, and she laughed.
Things were starting to look up. She had a job. The only thing she couldn't do was tell her girls where she was working. In the 5 weeks since Andrew's death, she had nearly drowned. And now, thanks to Paul, she was swimming to the surface again, and she knew she would survive.
Chapter 4 The morning after her lunch with Paul, Sydney woke up feeling anxious and excited. It seemed like 100 years since she'd last gone to work, and now she had a job at a successful company again, no matter how different it was from where she designed before. Her heart pounded when she thought of it, but she could hardly wait to get to the office. She had no idea what assignment she would get at first. She had a lot to get familiar with. She took the subway downtown and walked into the Lady Louise building in Hell's Kitchen at 5 to 9. Paul had told her to report to HR to fill out paperwork when she arrived. She took the elevator to the top floor of the remodeled warehouse complex, found the human resources office, and introduced herself. A girl who looked about Sabrina's age smiled at her, handed her the employee handbook, and put the papers to sign in front of her. She noticed that she would be getting health insurance, which was important to her since hers got canceled when Andrew died, and she couldn't afford to get sick now. The entire process took 30 minutes. The girl was brisk and efficient and asked if Sydney had any questions. She had one last paper to sign, which was her work contract. She and Paul hadn't discussed salary, and Sydney stared when she saw the amount listed on it. It wasn't even close to what she used to make when she was the head designer of a high-end fashion line, but it was far more than she had hoped to make now, or thought she deserved after a long hiatus. It showed Paul Zeller's respect for her and her talent, and what he thought she could do for his firm. 5 minutes after she signed the contract, she walked into his office and thanked him profusely. "You're paying me too much," she said, looking embarrassed, and he laughed and invited her to sit down. "You're the first employee who's ever said that to me. I think you're worth it, Sydney. I want you to give Lady Louise a touch of class we don't have now, just a little edgier and upmarket from what we've been doing. I think some of our clients are ready for it. We want to attract that client, and for those who aren't, they'll still have our lower-end lines." He looked at her, thoughtfully, admiring what she'd worn that day. She had picked a short black linen skirt, a simple white silk T-shirt, and high-heeled black linen pumps for her first day at work. She looked elegant and youthful, and everything she had on was chic and expensive. Sabrina would have approved of her outfit, but not the job she'd just taken. Sydney knew she was damn lucky to have it. She just hoped she could justify his faith in her. "I'm going to put you in the hands of our head of creative and design today. I want you to be his shadow for the next several months. He can teach you everything about our business. I had a meeting with him yesterday after our lunch. He's going to give you some projects so you can get your feet wet. He's a great guy and is responsible for some of our biggest successes. He has an unfailing eye," he said, smiling at her. "A lot like you. He'll be here in a few minutes." And as he said it, a tall, thin, young Chinese man walked into his office in a black T-shirt and black jeans, wearing high-topped black Converse. His hair was jet black and as long as Sydney's, and hung straight down his back, nearly to his waist, and the look suited him. He had a beautiful, delicately carved face, like an ivory statue, yet his whole style was modern, simple, and sleek. He greeted Paul in a businesslike way and looked Sydney over appraisingly. She couldn't tell if he liked what she was wearing or not, or if he approved of her getting the job. She wondered if people would be jealous of the fact that she'd been hired, or bothered by her age. She hadn't seen anyone even close to her age except Paul since she walked in, and so many of the design staff she'd glimpsed the day before looked like kids fresh out of school to her. Paul introduced them. The young Asian man's name was Edward Chin. He was 29 years old, and he had a British accent. Paul said he came from Hong Kong, had worked at Dior for 2 years, and been employed by Lady Louise for 3, and he'd risen to stardom in the company quickly. She thought it an interesting contrast that he'd gone from high-end, high-priced fashion to the low-priced lines Lady Louise produced. They spent a few minutes chatting in Paul's office,
And then Edward said he had work to do and invited Sydney to come with him. She felt suddenly overdressed compared to her new boss, but she had thought it best to dress well for her first day at work. She could see now that she'd be fine at work in future in jeans and even T-shirts, as long as she looked neat and presentable. Edward's outfit almost disappeared, and all that she noticed and was riveted by was his finely chiseled face and his intelligent dark eyes. She followed him to the design floor she had seen the day before with the 20 young designers frantically at work. None of them had private offices. They all worked in the big open space that looked like a loft, with brick walls, long, tall windows, and high ceilings. He walked her over to the table he'd assigned her, close to his own. Hers had an enormous desktop computer on it. There were several sketch pads, a box of pencils, erasers, sharpeners, and everything she needed. She felt like a kid on the first day of school.
"Paul said you don't design on a computer. You'll learn," Edward Chin assured her. "We're working on next spring right now. Half the group is working on tops and blouses. The more senior designers are working on jackets."
"What would you like me to do?" she asked, feeling slightly overwhelmed.
"I'll show you what we've got so far and what's been approved," he said seriously.
And she followed him to the large computer on his own desk, where he brought up a slew of designs. She was impressed by how clean and straightforward they were, could see easily that many of them were variations of the same pattern, which was economical for them, and admittedly, some of the designs and styles looked familiar to her. She concentrated on what he was showing her.
"Why don't you work off some of these today and see what you come up with? Try and stay within the parameters of what you're seeing, using the same bodies, and adding something new with collar, sleeve, detail, and stitching. Our size runs pretty broad, so it's got to look good on a size 12, too, and no tricky hidden closures, which are too costly to produce. This isn't what you're used to."
She nodded, not sure if he was being critical. So far, he'd been direct and matter-of-fact. He was intent and hadn't smiled at her yet. His clipped British way of speaking to her sounded educated. She noticed that he had long, graceful hands as he pointed to the designs on the screen. And then, while he was showing her a sketch on the computer, he picked up something that looked like a pencil and added some corrections to one of the designs on his computer screen. It was a special program, and he was literally drawing on the computer. It looked like magic to her, and she smiled as she watched him.
"I feel like I'm coming out of the Dark Ages," she admitted to him. 20 years ago, what you just did was science fiction."
He smiled at what she said.
"I had to learn it, too. I attended the Royal College of Art in London. They didn't believe in things like this 10 years ago. I did an internship with Stella McCartney, then worked for Alexander McQueen before I went to Dior. It's a big transition coming to work here, and Paul likes to keep everything digital, but a lot of the old principles apply. We just simplify and digitize them."
Sydney knew they also copied other people's designs a lot and only modified them slightly, so they didn't have to start every design from scratch the way famous designers did.
"I've seen a lot of your work," he said in a soft voice. "I'm a big fan. I did a project on just your coats once when I was in school. Your structure was fantastic. You taught me everything I know about working with stiff fabrics, which I prefer to softer ones like Nina Ricci or Chanel's evening gowns. We don't do a lot of evening wear here, at least not yet. We're stronger in day wear, and we have a bigger market for it. Evening wear is a much smaller market, and it's harder to produce. You can waste a lot of fabric if something goes wrong."
All of which she knew from experience. She was impressed by his history and whom he'd worked for before Lady Louise. It spoke well for the brand that he'd chosen to work there. And handed the sheets to her.
"You're going to do just fine. I know Paul has some big plans for you if things work out, but first, you need to learn the basics and how we do things. And I'm taking you to China with me when I go to see our factories in 3 weeks. That's not a problem for you, is it?"
He looked at her, questioningly.
We'll be gone for about 3 weeks. It'll be miserably hot there, but I'm overdue for a visit, and Paul wanted you to see it. Coordinating with our factories and keeping them on track is a big part of what I do, he explained to her. And just talking to him, she could tell that Paul's faith in him was well placed. He was brilliant and made everything simple and clear for her. She took the pages he gave her to her desk then and tried to focus on what she was doing, adding to basic designs to make them slightly more interesting without making them more expensive to produce. Two or three of the young female designers wandered by and shyly said hello to her as she sketched all morning. By lunchtime, she had only one design that she liked. The others still didn't seem right to her. She felt both rusty and green at the same time. When Ed Chin came by at 12:30 to see what she was doing, she wasn't satisfied with her work yet, but he was pleased. "I like that one," he said, pointing to one she had discarded and glancing at the others. "Those pockets would cost us a fortune," he said, indicating the one she liked, "and the double stitching. It's a great look, but we can't afford those touches here. We need to create that illusion, but find a cheaper way to do it. You have to keep your eye on cost at all times. It's about the look, without the high-end touches to back it up. You have to give something up in every design," he said, and smiled at her. "It's a whole new ballgame, and a challenge to let go of what we love most. You have to remember who our customer is and what they want to pay. We have a standard to uphold on pricing. That's our strength in the marketplace." He hadn't mentioned copying other people's designs, and seemed more interested in what she could come up with on her own to get a feeling for the flavor she could add to their line. And his pointers were helpful to her. She saw that he was eating a salad at his desk a little while later and didn't go to the cafeteria in the basement with the others. A lot of people went out for lunch, although one of the other designers told her that the food downstairs was good, but she decided to stay at her desk and work through lunch. She worked on the blouses and jackets all afternoon and stayed till 6 o'clock. Ed was still at his desk when she left and said goodnight to him. "How did the first day feel?" he asked her with interest. He didn't let on to her, but it impressed him that she was working there. "Thrilling, scary, new, and familiar in some ways. I'm excited about the trip to China you mentioned. I've never been to Asia before." He smiled when she said it. "It's an education, especially in this business. Everyone produces there now, even the big-ticket name brands. It just doesn't make sense to produce mass-market goods anywhere else anymore. The factory towns in China are miserable, the pollution is awful, and working in Beijing can be rough. It's a lot less sophisticated than here. But the work ethic is tremendous, and the sheer number of workers at their disposal. I'm planning to visit my family in Hong Kong on the way back, and you're welcome to join me. I think you'll love it. It's a fantastic city." He looked at her warmly when he said it. "Thank you." She was touched by his invitation and couldn't wait for the trip. "Does your family mind you being here?" Paul had hinted that he was from an important Hong Kong family. "They expected it. They want me to get experience in the States. My family is in manufacturing for all the high-end European and American brands, so they encouraged me to see and experience how it all works here. Lady Louise is a little bit of a detour for me, but it's an important market, too. Our factories produce all the goods for Chanel that are made in Asia, Prada, Gucci, and the big-name American brands. China is where it's all happening now. I'll go back eventually, but I'm not ready to yet. I still have a lot to discover here." He seemed to be learning his lessons well, since he had such an important job with Paul. She knew from Paul that they relied on him heavily for the look of their brand, and he wouldn't be designing if he went home and got involved in the family's manufacturing business. So he was savoring it for now, even at Lady Louise. He seemed to think of it as a challenge, not a step down. She said goodnight to him then, and thought about him on the subway ride home. He was a very intelligent man and clearly had an enormous talent. She would have liked to introduce him to her girls, although they would have been critical of where he worked, but he had a lot in common with them and a pure